Hey, this is Andrea Swenson, and you're listening to The OK Show. It's a show that features real musicians talking about their real lives, and it's brought to you by The Current. On today's episode, we're going to meet an elder statesman of the Twin Cities jazz community. His name is Irv Williams, and at 96 years old, he's the oldest living musician still performing and recording music here in Minnesota. We'll hear from Irv in just a moment, but first, a little background about his life and why I wanted to invite him onto this show. If you've listened to previous episodes of The OK Show, you'll know that I'm very interested in how artists' health affects their ability to make music. We've talked about mental health, disease, depression, grief, all such serious topics at the core of some of today's most moving songwriting. Well, today we're taking a totally different approach because Irv Williams, though he has had his share of health issues over the years, has managed to stay active, healthy, and remain prolific well into his ninth decade. He recorded what many thought was going to be his farewell album. It was called That's All in 2004. And not only did he refuse to retire following that album's release, but he's gone on to record and release six more albums since then, including this year's Pinnacle. Irv's list of accomplishments is lengthy. In addition to his 11 albums, he was the first jazz musician to be awarded his own Irv Williams Day by the state of Minnesota. He's received the KBEM Lifetime Achievement Award. He's been inducted into the Minnesota Jazz Hall of Fame. And the saxophone that he played for over 35 years is on display at the Minnesota History Center. When Irv celebrated his 96th birthday in August, the Dakota Jazz Club was overflowing with fellow musicians and friends who came to see him play. And when I paid him a visit for this interview, we were interrupted many times by phone calls from artists who were checking in on him and neighbors who couldn't help but stop by to say hello. Within minutes of meeting him, it was easy to understand why everyone wants to talk to Irv. Not only is he a living legend, but he just so happens to be one of the sweetest, most endearing gentlemen I'd ever had the chance to interview.
I am here now with Irv Williams. He's been kind enough to invite me over to his apartment building in St. Paul. Thank you, Irv, for speaking with me today.
My pleasure.
I was wondering if you could take me back to the very beginning of your life in music. What are some of your earliest memories of music, and what made you want to become a musician yourself?
Well, the first time I when there's music around was my father singing in the shower.
Mm.
And he sang in the church choir and everything. And but I began to appreciate what they're doing with the choir and everything, because they rehearsed and they sound pretty good in those years.
Mm. You know?
So that's my first experience with music. And then my grandfather, I was a premature baby in, 1911, something like that. My grandmother, after I was born, they put me in a crib saying that I was stillborn. You know?
Mm.
So my grandmother's poking around, she said, I won't accept that, you know. So she picked me up, and so they tell me she busted me on the butt, and I started crying. And she told me years ago, if I had known you were going to cry that much, I'd have left you in that crib.
Oh, no.
Yeah, well, I was hurting all the time.
You know? Mm.
And it was until I was 6 or 7, we were a musical family. And she wanted me to have something to play, so she wanted me to do the violin.
Oh.
So she bought a pint-sized violin, and I didn't like it worth anything. So I picked up the clarinet, and my dad bought this clarinet for $10. And so I started playing that and taking lessons on Saturday from a mail carrier who sold it. And it was driving him crazy. And he finally said, you will not play that clarinet anymore until I tell you to. He says, because you're messing up your lungs and everything. And so I'll let you know when to play. But the fact was, I was driving him crazy. You know? Because when he got in from work, he didn't want that knowing. I wanted to master that instrument.
Yeah.
And I did. And then I bought the saxophone later.
So how old were you when you started playing saxophone?
I was about 13, 12 or 13, something like that.
Okay.
And I progressed very rapidly on that. And I was a professional musician at 19.
Really?
I just finished high school, so I decided to get a union card and everything. So I started working.
Wow.
Very little, but every little bit helped.
You know? Yeah. And then what kind of clubs were hiring?
Nobody. Not young kids, no. We had one gig. I don't remember what it's all about, but this is in Little Rock, Arkansas.
Mm.
There was a place called 555, and they talked to the band director about us doing one night up there. You know? And so we did one night. Everybody liked it so well that we started doing matinees on Saturday.
So you grew up in Arkansas?
Yeah, mostly, because okay. I didn't leave until my grandmother died. My grandmother died when I was 10, I think I was 10, because I went to Little Rock, Arkansas, where my dad was practicing medicine.
Okay.
And I got my schooling down there, and I went to college, Pine Bluff, Arkansas.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then what brought you to Minnesota?
The Navy.
Uh-huh.
During the war years.
Okay, so describe the Minneapolis scene in the 40s. What was going on at that time?
They didn't have much music that I liked.
Mm.
I was all tri-jazz, which is trombone, clarinet, and trumpet, and a rhythm section, three-part rhythms, piano, bass, and drums. It was really, what it really was swing. Which most of the white bands are doing, you know. We were off from that long time ago, you know.
Yeah.
And I was doing what we call modern swing music. A guy named Fletcher Henderson had a band in New York, and he opened up his arrangements for solos. And none of the other bands would do that, you know. Oh. They just go ahead and play, and then those solos were... And, of course, that made the numbers a lot longer and everything. So everybody started doing that.
Once you moved up here, what kind of clubs were available for jazz musicians in the 40s and 50s?
I came here, I had a daughter here, so I came to see her after I got out.
Mm.
I think 47 I got out, if I'm mistaken.
Okay.
And anyhow, there wasn't much going on up here, you know. The black musicians that were working out in the county, and one of the great jazz musicians of all time, a guy named Lester Young was a saxophone player that was internationally known. And the only place he could work would be out in the county, and I couldn't understand that. So there was not much work available. But I joined a white band, and we went up to Fargo, and then we went to a little town on the Canadian border called Williston, North Dakota. So I played up there one summer, and it started getting cold, so I came down here and got lucked up on a job. Trumpet player opened up an old hotel that had been closed up because the people that had it could not finished all the work in it.
Mm-hmm.
So we used to play in their ballroom. You know, everything would go up to probably the fifth floor or something like that. And I played with him.
Okay.
It's called the same thing now, but I can't think of the name of it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
It's on Calhoun. It's on Lake Calhoun.
Oh, the Calhoun Beach Club?
Yeah.
Huh.
That was the place that I made my first gig.
Wow, you know? Interesting.
Yeah.
And did you say you had joined a white band? Were you the only black musician?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you said that the black artists were only able to play in the county, what do you mean by that? Further out of the city, or?
They could go out and play in the county, but there's nobody working in town, in the town, you know.
Okay.
I don't know what caused it, but
yeah.
There's nobody working.
Yeah.
You'd go up and down Hennepin, and you wouldn't see any black faces at all entertaining, you know.
Right.
But when we, some of the guys that I was with stayed also, so we formed a band. And we were quite a bit because we were different. We were more modern and everything. And we never played shoddishes or polkas and that stuff.
Hmm.
So from there, I progressed pretty good. I was at the Hilton Hotel. I think it was 12 years I was there, the
wow.
lead of the band, yeah.
Wow.
From 1962 to 72, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
So as the the civil rights movement picked up in the 60s, did you mm-hmm. notice a shift in the music scene of more opportunities for black musicians, or just more acceptance?
No, it had grown pretty good during the war, and a lot of people were working because there were no other musicians to call, you know.
Yeah.
And so it did open up quite a bit, and I've been working very well ever since.
Good.
Yeah.
That's good. Curious, looking at your repertoire, what draws you to the Great American Songbook? What do you like about that era of songwriting?
Well, there are so many songs, and all of them are different. There's so much originality in an American Songbook. Now, it's entirely different. You know, young kids have taken over, and they talk about, sing about their experiences and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But sometimes the melodies are coincided, one melody and five different experiences or five different approach on the lyrics and everything like that. But the Great American Songbook was so much music, you know?
Yeah.
And the people that were heirs to the people that wrote these things are interested in one thing, and that is the money that they can get out of it. So for me, it never caught me, you know, because I just try to stay away from the melodies as much as I can and just compose different melodies and everything, but on the same chord procedures.
Sure. I really liked on your new album the performance of Lush Life,
mm-hmm.
Which I think you do a little bit of that you mentioned. You mm-hmm. play the melody, but then you're also kind of almost doing mm-hmm. a counter melody and adding all of these mm-hmm. things.
Oh, that is such a hard tune.
It is, yeah.
And the guy that wrote it was just a genius. Mm-hmm.
I read that you taught junior high for a while. When was that?
Well, I got out of the service, and I taught probably in the late 50s and early 60s.
Okay, so it was in Minnesota.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I went to both city high schools and junior high schools and talked about music.
Hmm.
And I enjoyed it very much.
Yeah.
Especially the kids are really interested in jazz music. I thought maybe it'd be a kind of a awakening, but no, it hasn't happened. Mm. Jazz is even worse off than it was before the war. Nobody's playing it much.
Mm. What do you think about the young players that are playing out in town now?
They're great, but they don't bend to anything that would make them more acceptable, you know.
Mm.
They have their own tunes and everything, and they have their own singing and everything. And a lot of it's repetitious, I guess.
Yeah.
And but the kids, you know, they can sit down and get these groups, and they know all the songs and they're singing while the band is playing.
Mm.
We never did that in jazz, very seldom. We'd stop them.
Did you have a mentor or role model that you looked up to when you were learning more about jazz?
I had so many role models because mm-hmm. there's so many guys that I was in favor of going to hear trumpet players. I didn't care about sax, my clarinet players, but all my friends who were trumpet, are trumpet players. One just died last week, Clark Terry.
Oh.
Yeah. We were school chums and everything.
Wow.
He was with the Tonight Show band, one of the first black guys getting the Tonight Show. And so he passed away, and it really, really hurt.
Mm.
It really did.
I'm sorry. One other thing I wanted to ask you about is, like I said, I'm really interested in the 60s and 70s music,
sure.
just personally. And
sure.
I'm curious, you know, as the kind of next generation of saxophone players and trombone players and trumpet players came up and started playing more like funk music and mm-hmm. soul music, what did you think about that kind of transition in the scene?
Oh, I thought it was great.
Yeah.
You know, most of them devoid of any technique or anything like that. That could be good sometimes, you know.
Yeah.
Because you play over a person's head if you play too many notes and stuff like that. So I thought it was great.
Yeah.
I know that there were a lot of black bands that had that sang as much as they played. And
right.
That's good.
What do you think has kept you faithful to jazz for your career? What keeps you coming back to that art form?
The only thing that I love it and I play it pretty well, and that's the reason why, you know. I never ventured into rock and roll. I played in St. Louis with what is his name? Well-known rock and roll guy. Somebody recommended me that he needed a saxophone player. His saxophone player was sick or something like that. So he asked me to come down and play in his band. So I went down, and he wasn't happy at all, you know. He says, you better get back to jazz. I says, because you're not going to work this out.
Oh, boy.
I can't think of his name.
One thing that I love about jazz, and I play a little jazz myself sometimes, is the idea of improvising. Mm-hmm. And this idea of you are still following predetermined, you know, chord changes, and,
yeah,
and there are a lot of rules, but still it's all very mysterious where the melodies kind of form and come from.
Mm-hmm.
What are you thinking about when you are improvising?
I just think about the melody and stay away from it, you know, as much as I can.
Mm.
Just play the chord changes, and sometimes if you come up with a counter melody, you can play the same chord changes to play this counter melody. You
know? Yeah.
That happens quite a bit in jazz.
Yeah. So, you just turned 96.
Mm-hmm.
You've been playing saxophone for longer than most people have been
mm-hmm.
alive.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think you would tell a young musician starting out now? What advice do you have looking back on your long career?
Well, I have gotten into a lot of trouble telling the truth. You know. The jazz music schools are expensive, and I was a guest at one, and the guy asked me, what do you think about the scene today, you know? So I told him, I said, well, jazz is basically asleep. It'll never die, but it's asleep, you know? And people find out later about it, and it'll get popular again, you know? It's happened through the life span of the music. And when you work, what do you think about working? Can you work steady and all this and everything? I said, well, I've been very lucky, but I'm in the top echelon of the business. I said, what I did, I got a day job and played at night as much as I could. And eventually I played I met people that were helping me get work and stuff like that, and now I don't have to worry about work because I can play music all the time, you know. And they asked me about school. I said, well, I can't see any reason that you shouldn't get some out of it and everything. Any knowledge is worth having. And as far as work is concerned, it depends upon the individual and what's going on and how lucky you are and stuff. But I said, it's not a business where you can go from one place to another and play, or go out of town and play and then come back and play or stuff like that. It's just not that many people doing it anymore. And I gave them an example of what, when I left the Hilton Hotel downstairs in Minneapolis, they changed managers. This is 70, 72, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
They changed managers, and when they changed managers, they did a different thing. The music would have to pay for itself. Before, they were spending the money and letting people come up and dance and buy food and stuff like that, but it was always a loss.
Mm.
So I told them I don't see any future for jazz, you know. But as far as education is concerned, any knowledge is worth what you put into it.
Yeah.
And those guys are just angry at me, you know. But I've been people angry with me before, so I tell the truth, so I don't care, you know.
I'm curious for you, from a creative standpoint, as a musician, what has kept you pushing forward throughout your life? What keeps you motivated?
The main thing for me is I was changing the way the guys play. I wanted to play differently, and possibly, if I could, go outside the chord, something like that, which I do. And I don't do it enough that it would mask the melody, you know.
Yeah.
But it's my style, you know, and people come and say, why don't you play the melody? I said, the melody is right there. If you want to hear it, just hum it while I'm playing, you know. And I hum so-and-so. I said, okay, I'll play it the next set. You can understand. So, and he said, oh, that's right. I hum the melody to Can't Get Started. And I could hum right along with it. I said, well, that's what jazz is all about, you know.
Hmm.
They've changed you, taken a tune and changed. Now they're writing all their own stuff now, you know, but during this period of time, we'd take all the great American songbook and mess it up, you know. We'd play a little bit of everything. So it was very enjoyable. It's like discovering gold, you know.
Well, thank you, Herb, for talking to me.
My pleasure.
This was just a delight.
Thank you so much.
Well, there you have it. Thank you again to Irv Williams for the great conversation about his life as the elder statesman of the Twin Cities jazz community. Irv celebrated a couple of huge milestones recently. Not only did he turn 96, but he's put out a new album, Pinnacle, which you can find in stores now. This has been another installment of The OK Show. Tune in next week. We're going to talk to Maida about her journey as a Korean adoptee living in Minnesota, traveling back to Korea in search of her birth parents, and a health scare that almost prevented her from following her passion of making amazing pop funk music. This has been The OK Show from The Current in St. Paul. My name is Andrea Swenson, and until next time, it's going to be OK. Thank you.